Welcome to the 91st episode of Reverse Rep Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 87 years to the day that the great Dulip Singhji hit a glorious 333 in just over 5 hours for Sussex against Northants. If he had been playing today during our podcast, he'd have probably made about 44 of them before the end of the episode.
I never knew you were so good at maths, actually. So how many runs would he make in the total aggregate minutes of all Reverse Rep Radio episodes thus far?
Well, if he's going... just give me, you know, this about has got the rest like of the episode to work it out.
This question. It really does. Anyway, not going too far into politics. Thank you for joining us for the next 40 or so runs worth of entertainment that we aim to give you. We're going to be, as ever, looking at what's happened over the last little while in the women's game, in the international game, and in Andy's club game as well. Why not? Andy's also going to be telling us about the massacre at Sabina Park. What a tantalizing headline that is. And we are going to be reviewing On Top, Down Under, the great book on Australia's cricket captains by Ray Robinson. So it's been a few weeks in the world of cricket. A few things have happened, including your link to cricket fame has disappeared.
Yeah, a bit of a personal calamity for me in Zafar Ansari's retirement, because it's really hit my ability to names drop. I played with Zafar a little bit at school level, even though he was quite a lot younger than me, and obviously, you know, quite a lot.
Which says something,
me.
Yeah.
But so I'm no longer able. My one degree of separation from Surrey and occasionally the England cricket team has now disappeared. But more seriously, I didn't really know quite how to greet this news. There is something initially very sad about a talented, fully fit and healthy 25-year-old deciding to give up a game that he's rather brilliant at. But I think the more I thought about it, the more I applauded the courage of the decision. He's obviously got a huge amount out of the game, but has decided that's enough is enough. And there's a very good, as is so often the case, Michael Atherton piece on the retirement. And he said, you know, to be great at cricket, you need to be dedicated to the point of obsession. And obsession is limiting and often destructive. And I think it does seem to be that for someone like Zafar Ansari, who has many interests beyond the game, he had just got to the point where that limitation was too much. And I think everyone certainly wishes him all the best for his new career.
It's kind of a bit of a recurring theme on the podcast, this issue of cricketers who hang on too long, who just do not know when to retire. And in many ways, it's an impossible question. And the only way that you can really kind of grab that particular ball by the horns is by just saying at some point in your life, this is great, but actually I've got other things I want to do with my life. And actually it must take a real strength of character to do that, because particularly for someone who's kind of, you know, around the fringes of the England team, you know, he was definitely going to have a solid county career. It really takes, you know, a considerable degree of character to stand up and say, no, I'm going to do something else. I was interested in the fact that when he was playing for England, he actually came out and very honestly just said, look, I look around at the other players in this room and I realise I have nowhere near the amount of talent that any of these other people do. And again, the strength of personality to therefore say, I need to go and do something else, rather than saying, oh, it may be that I might get a few tests down the line, you know, really shows something quite good about him, I think, as a person.
Yes, and I think he is obviously very exceptional in that he had choices and he had options. And for a lot of other players, their ability to be obsessed with the game often stems from that, that it really is their thing, and he has choices. And no, I completely agree with you. There is also something very admirable in his ability to look very clear-sightedly at how far he was ever likely to go in cricket.
So what's he going to do we think?
So a career in law...
You know him better than I do.
Well, a career, a career in law beckons, and he has a real passion and interest in the civil rights movement. So I wonder if a move into politics of some variety in the near future may not be on the cards. So yes, I think this is very much a watch this space.
There we go, you heard it here first.
Now, you have been looking at, well, and this is a rare feature on the podcast, looking at the ICC doing something that might just be good.
Yeah, so I was interested to see that the ICC, in their kind of usual slightly odd way, have decided to get serious about women's cricket. And so they've decided that the 2017 World Cup, this year is the Women's Cricket World Cup, is going to have a couple of significant changes from previous versions of the tournament. So for a start, they're doubling the prize money that the team that wins will get to make it a much more serious amount. The entire tournament will be televised, and they're also going to, you know, bring in some kind of serious technical innovation. So the spider cam, which I think is that thing that kind of hangs from the spotlights and kind of sweeps across the ground and nearly takes out players, is actually going to make its debut in women's cricket during the 2017 World Cup. But it's also going to be being used for the first time at Lord's in any form of cricket. And, you know, it's interesting that for once it's the women's game that the ICC should have decided should lead the way, which is a fantastic thing. And this is all part of a kind of package that they're putting together to try and achieve parity between the men's and women's game within the next 15 years. When I was reading this report, I sort of thought that there was something a little bit galling about the fact that, given that there are these kind of, in a way, quick fixes, double the prize money. Look, the ICC's rolling in money, they can do that pretty easily. Why haven't they ever done that before? You know, why is it only now that they've suddenly decided, oh, we're going to make this a priority and we're going to try and get some parity between the men's and the women's game? But the fact that they've kind of nailed their colours to the mast and set out this roadmap whereby they're saying that this is going to be achieved really can only be seen as a good thing, I think.
And I think there's a lot generally to compliment with cricket's approach here. I think last year it was very notable that BBC gave a lot of coverage to the English domestic women's 2020. They gave it lots of radio coverage, it was online. And you can see with these things that it doesn't change overnight, but incrementally you start to build the audience. You start to get slightly bigger crowds at these games, more people tuning in. And I think it's not something that changes overnight, but I mean, hopefully you will get the crowds at these Women's World Cup games that it deserves.
Now, tell us about the crowds at your club games on a Sunday. Do you get the crowds you deserve?
Well, do you know what we do get a good crowd in every Sunday. It's often a question of the motivations of the crowd. So we have a core part of our crowd that are primarily
whether they're rioting or whether they're there.
They're primarily they're happiest when the team is taking a thumping and can really revel in that and can sort of abuse individual players, laugh at particular mistakes,
and probably give helpful advice as well from the boundary. Yeah. We all know about that.
These are the kind of people who will serve you a pint afterwards and then say, oh, mind you don't drop it, that sort of thing. While our crowd is very reliable, one thing that has been less reliable this team is our team itself. So I've been very lucky for a long time to play in a side that has had no problem getting 11 people together. In fact, for much of the time I've been playing, the captain has often been in the position of, I need to pick 11 from, 14, 15 who are available. Over the winter, we had a few players who've retired, a few players who've moved away from the area, and all of a sudden, getting a team together for Sunday has started to there's been a bit of desperation to it. You know, we're getting the last-minute text messages coming out, the please, do you know anybody, this sort of thing.
Anyone with two arms and two legs.
Exactly, and I mean, I'm hoping this is just a dip, and these things are to some extent cyclical. You know, a couple of people go, a couple of people come in. But it's been an interesting reminder to me about, generally within the English game, clubs are fielding fewer teams than they were. So, there are teams that maybe 10, 15 years ago were fielding, third, fourth, 11s, two teams on a Sunday and whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
These teams aren't doing that anymore. They're all, and I think it's brought home to me the way that that can happen very easily. You know, you go from having a very set team to suddenly lose a couple of people, and then you just have to cancel a couple of games because you can't raise a team, and then suddenly cancelling those games somehow becomes the norm, and then other teams think twice about organising games with you, and it can all sort of spiral. A kind of worrying indication of where club cricket can go in some occasions.
Mm-hmm. I think as well, though, there is something that's a bit sort of cyclical about this. So, occasionally you have the good feeling in the team and everyone's a bit of a bunch of mates and everyone wants to come and everything like that, and then a few key people leave and suddenly there's not the buzz around it. But often that kind of comes back, doesn't it? Because I think there is something about that form of social casual cricket that does depend on, people getting on and the vibe in the team and everything like that. Fingers crossed that keep on pouring those pints, and hopefully at some point the things will pick up again.
Yes, no, we hope so. And as we try and cling on to our fixture schedule, you've been looking at Australia's rather bizarre and slightly perplexing fixture schedule.
Yeah, so I was actually chatting to a colleague of mine the other day, and we were talking about cricket. He's an Australian, but you know, we all have our sins. And he was saying, "Oh, do you know what the next Australia series is?" Before we're chatting about the Ashes, and he was saying, "Oh, do you know what the next Australia series is before the Ashes?" And I was thinking to myself, "Do you know what? I don't know who Australia are playing next in Tests. They've just come back from India." And so I looked it up, and I was amazed to find out that Australia will not be playing a Test series between the Test series in India, which ended in March, and facing England in the Ashes in November. So for 9 months, they won't play a single game of Test cricket. And actually, what's interesting is that they won't actually be playing much cricket at all during that time. So there's the Champions Trophy, and you know, it may only be that if all of our wishes come true, that Australia only end up playing three games in that tournament, or whatever just the group stages are. And then they'll be coming straight into the Ashes from there. And you kind of wonder whether they're going to be hopelessly undercooked. So I was actually comparing this to last year when, during the same time period, they played an ODI series against South Africa, a T20 ODI and Test series against Sri Lanka, and a three-way ODI tournament against South Africa and the West Indies. And it seems like this perennial thing with the international calendar, we can just never get it right. You know, it really can't be that difficult to sit down with a spreadsheet and a little map and just draw a few arrows here and there and map it out. But the ICC somehow always managed to get either too much cricket or too little cricket in there. And I do wonder, when it comes to that first test of the Ashes, how this will actually play out.
Yeah, and it is difficult because we see at the moment in England there's a big focus on the ODIs ahead of the Champions Trophy, and to some extent those periods of concentration do make sense. But there's this basic problem that for the integrity of the Test game, there's this ideal where all the Test nations pretty much play each other pretty much the same number of times. And I feel like that's a very simple ideal that it would be lovely to work towards. In reality, we have this problem that when England play Australia, everyone makes a ton load of money. When anyone plays India, they make a ton load of money. And unfortunately, you know, England, South Africa, which is one of my favourite series, I always enjoy that as a series, and we are getting that this summer, in contrast, is not a money spinner. So we end up with this slightly uneven thing.
From the archives. In this episode, Andy is going to be telling us about the massacre at Sabina Park.
So, by the second innings of the final test of the 1976 series between the West Indies and India, five Indian batsmen were absent through injury. And I'm going to look at the story of how that game got to that vaguely extraordinary stage. So the pitch in Jamaica had recently been relayed and was, I think to put it politely, lively. One end in particular had very, very variable bounce, which I think with all of these things is the really difficult thing. I mean, if it's a very, very hard pitch and the ball is always rising at you hard consistently, you can at least play for that. But on a pitch where some are going like through and some are really launching at you, that's when things get difficult. In spite of this, it started well for India. They got to 178 for one on the first day, but Sunil Gavaskar, very much their star player at this time, had already taken several heavy blows. And I should add that this was the deciding game in the series, so it's one apiece, so there was plenty at stake here. The arrival of the new ball on the second day, however, was where things started to get interesting. It promptly triggered a collapse and the start of the injuries, so within basically a couple of hours we had three Indian casualties. Gundapa Viswanath was caught at backward short leg off holding, and his finger was both fractured and dislocated, which sounds extremely painful. And I was almost reading that description having to work out exactly how that works, because I can see how you do one or the other.
Best not to think about it, manage both
with one delivery. Brijesh Patel then edged a ball from Van Burn Holder into his mouth, had to retire. Anshuman Gaikwad was not much long later struck just above the left ear by a bouncer that kept low, which I think really reiterates the danger of that variable bounce. So both of them are having to
retire. When you're ducking into a bouncer, that's when you get terrified. And was the bowling particularly aggressive? Was there a lot of short pitch bowling?
There was, and I think the general conclusion, and we'll sort of, you know, get into the debate about what different sides thought of this. I think the conclusion from many neutral observers was there was probably too much. Tony Kozier, the late great Tony Kozier, described Michael Holding as ferocious that day, and I think he was very much the lead of that West Indian attack, as he of course so often was. With two batsmen having to retire hurt, Bishan Bedi took the interesting decision to declare India's innings at 306 for 6 in order to protect himself and Chandrasekhar from possible injury. Now, I guess you can read this in very different ways, in that some people have read it as sort of an act of cowardice, but I think you could look at it as just a very practical thing. I mean, Chandrasekhar and Bedi were India's best bowlers. They were India's best hope of still being competitive in this game. And the idea of sending them out to get hurt would really have harmed their prospects. And I think also the key thing to stress is that both of them were extremely weak batsmen. In fact, Wisden makes the case that they may have been the two weakest batsmen in Test cricket at the time. India come out and bowl really well. They get the West Indies to 217 for 6. Which is a great comeback. Crucially, though, the West Indies' tail wagged pretty emphatically and got them to 391 and an 85-run lead. The second innings for India was altogether less dramatic than the first and over a lot more quickly. India are reduced to 97 for 5 off 25 overs, and at that point the innings is over with just 5 wickets down. Viswanath, Patel and Gaikwad are all unable to bat from their first injuries, and Bedi and Chandrasekhar don't bat. It's interesting, when I first read this, it said that they'd hurt their fingers while attempting return catches, and I was somewhat sceptical, thinking this seems very, very convenient. Apparently, further digging suggests that this may well have actually been the case. So you have this extraordinary position where the West Indies, where India have no option, it appears, to end their innings only 12 runs ahead of the West Indies. The West Indies promptly come out, get the runs, and they complete a series victory. And they have...
But you kind of wonder with that last inning, sorry to interrupt, but the you kind of think that the... Would you do anything different in that position? You've got your batsman injured. The only people left to come in are pretty weak batsmen who are also your bowlers. Are you really going to put them in the line of fire for the sake of what are you hoping to make? Another 20, 30 runs? And you've seen all of your batsmen go off injured. You kind of... I mean, it treads the line, but you kind of think, can you really blame them for just saying, you know, bugger this for a game of soldiers, we're gonna declare at this point?
Yeah, and I think you see teams make similar assessments, don't you? So I think the classic one is, if you have an injured batsman who is not intending to bat, and teams will sometimes take the view, look, if it's really close and there's a couple of overs to bat out for a draw, or we only need a couple more for the win,
we'll send the poor guy out.
Yeah, I mean, I remember a great an England Bangladesh ODI a few years back where we were sending out Ian Bell hobbling because we only needed a handful more to win, which we actually then didn't get. But it's those sort of situations. I think you're quite right that at 12 runs ahead, what were they going to do? Not surprisingly, the two teams had very different interpretations on what had taken place. Bishan Bedi was pretty emphatic. The West Indian tactics were not part of the game. They were a deliberate effort to subdue us. In contrast, the West Indies, Clyde Walcott, their manager, India were ill-equipped to play fast bowling, while Clive Lloyd, the West Indies captain, this is cricket. If you get hit, you have to take it. And I think this sort of argument about the place of violence and aggression in cricket is one that you come across again and again in the game's history. Ultimately, I think the fundamentals of it aren't that different to the sort of conversation we were having in Bodyline. I think it's these two lines of, you know, part of cricket is a sort of macho, brave game, and the other part saying that actually violence in this sort of aggression is not part of the game.
And it sort of depends what kind of a team you have as well. Again, like Bodyline, you know, it was because England had Harold Larwood, who was such a brilliant fast bowler, that actually the problem was exacerbated. And, you know, similarly here, I would assume that the West Indian fast bowlers were much, much more lethal, really, than the Indian fast bowlers. And therefore, that it was always going to be one-sided in this regard. I was interested to read a report the other day about the West Indian-Pakistan series that's happening at the moment. And the West Indian coach was saying, we won the second test, but we won it despite the pitch, because our bowlers, our West Indian bowlers, are bowlers who exist on pace. That's all really that we do, and that we need pitches to suit that. And you see something, I think, a bit like that here, where you have a West Indian team that is built around bowling fast, and an Indian team led by Bishan Bedi, which is not built around bowling fast. And it's a kind of clash of cultures in that sense as well, I think.
Yeah, and I think in terms of this traditional view we have of the West Indies as a team built around bowling fast, this test is a key point in that development. The previous test match, India had comfortably chased down 400 against basically a West Indies spin attack, and I think that had been incredibly chastening for Clive Lloyd in the West Indies. And I think it's one of the things to realise that this aggressive approach came not from a position of strength, but from desperation. West Indies had just lost a series 5-1 in Australia, where they had been hounded by the short bowling of the Australians, Lillian Thompson. And they're 1-1 in a series against India, where everyone expects them to win at home. It's not going too far to say that Clive Lloyd's captaincy could well have been in jeopardy had they failed to win this match and the series. I think it's interesting that the neutrals, as far as you know, they can ever be sort of true neutrals, Wisden looked at it and said there was too much short bowling, the umpires should have intervened. I think the other thing that is particularly damning is the amount of beamers that are discussed in the match reports. And while we can have conversations about the amount of short bowling and umpires coming in and saying, no, that's too many bounces, we can all agree that beamers are never have a place in the
you
game.
You can't blame the pitch for a beamer.
No, absolutely. And I think also,
try as you might, you can't blame.
I'm very comfortable with the idea that if you're flinging a ball down at 90 mile an hour, you may occasionally lose control and bowl a beamer. If they're being bowled regularly, you have to come to the rather sad conclusion that they're being done in a systematic way to intimidate the batsman. This game has really imprinted itself, perhaps in West Indian cricket history, but also in Indian cricket history. And Sunil Gavaskar dedicated an entire chapter to the test in his autobiography. He titled the chapter Barbarism in Kingston, which gives you a sense of what he was talking about. Rather sadly, his account degenerates really into a series of racial slurs about the West Indian cricket fans. But when he isn't doing that, he talks about the things the crowd was saying. So he says that they would encourage Michael Holding with shouts of "Kill him, man! Hit him, man! Knock his head off, Mike!" And I think it does give you this broader image of when the West Indies became this fearsome, unbeatable side. It was partly about that incredible bowling quartet, but it was also about the fact that this was a tough place to go. The hostility came both from the pitch, but also from a crowd who loved that style of cricket, who wanted an intimidatory, macho style of cricket. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading On Top Down Under, Australia's Cricket Captains by Ray Robinson. First published in 1975, it has since been repeatedly revised and most recently updated with the help of the great Gideon Hay. No cricket library could be without it, was the assessment of Sir Donald Bradman.
Now, my cricket library, I don't know about you, Andy, but my cricket library was without this book until, in fact, just a few days ago, and I hadn't actually come across it or come across Ray Robinson beforehand, which probably says a lot about me, but I think says a little bit about this book as well. I was mentioning it to a cricket-loving Australian friend of mine who was kind of raving about it, but I was interested when I was kind of Googling it to see that actually On Top Down Under is the name of a slightly insalubrious website of a different kind, and it's difficult to find anything out about this particular book. And partly that's interesting because when you read it, it's a remarkable book, but also Ray Robinson is a remarkable man and a remarkable writer. He actually is of a school of cricket writers that we don't have nowadays, really. He's not an ex-player. He wasn't an ex-player. He died in the 1980s. He wasn't an ex-player, and actually he spent his whole life really struggling to really get onto the, you know, get into the newspaper in a concerted way. He was always a bit of a sub-editor, always having to take the bad jobs, as it were, in order to get to finally work his way into the newspaper and onto the radio. He died eventually in Sydney in 1982. And this book is something that's been updated sort of throughout his life as new Australian captains have come along. And it's got a chapter on, I believe, anyone to ever captain Australia, one way or other. And for me, it was a real actual insight into how much I didn't know about Australian cricket history. The number of people here, you know, they're really familiar people, the Bill Woodfulls, the, you know, the Borders, people like that, even going back a long way into the early part of the 20th century. But there are so many people here who I had just never heard of and had really, really significant careers. Was it a discovery in that way for you as well?
Yeah, I think particularly in the early days when the captaincy was altogether a bit less official, and in fact in the early days when it was voted for by the players and the captaincy
just before the game.
Exactly, and the captaincy was sort of being shared around a lot more. I mean, now it's much more of a sort of full-time professional occupation, and changing it is a very, very significant event. I mean, I think, as you said, Ray Robinson's path to cricket writing fame was a very hard one. And I think you see here the meticulousness of the sub-editor. The research he has done is staggering. I mean, in page after page. But what I think I particularly appreciate is just the endless conversations he's obviously had. There are so many moments where he'll casually just drop in, you know, I was speaking to so-and-so's child, or I was speaking to someone who had watched him play here. And you see that actually, a lot of the skill here is about the patience to just talk and talk and talk to anyone who had ever seen them. And that really builds up that more complete portrait. One thing I slightly worried about is where this research possibly goes too far is in Robinson's love of statistics. And I just, as one point, as a just experiment, counted in one paragraph 11 stats used in one single paragraph. I was going to read it to you, but then I thought I wouldn't do that. I'd save you all that.
But not every paragraph's like that.
No, that's true.
In his defense, yes. There are, and I think sometimes there is, you know, there are really dense statistics that are delivered, but it's not a book that's founded on statistics. You get insights into people's characters that are quite a long way beyond that, I think. And a lot of one of the things that Ray Robinson is kind of renowned for is the fact that he had really, really close personal relationships with a lot of the players. And so he knew, you know, there was Gideon Hay talks about in his intro to the book, talks about the fact he had a rare trust, frankly, for a journalist with players, and a rare, you know, close friendship with them. And I think a lot of that comes out in some of the anecdotes that come through as well, that I do think, because you're right, when the stats come, they're dense, but they are, I think, counterbalanced by some of the more personal insights as well.
I think that's fair, and I, you know, it's always a little bit unfair on a writer to pick sort of an individual part. And I think in terms of his broader assessment of character, he's really interested in how players' professions link into the way they play and the way they captained. And obviously that's something that increasingly is very different. You've got a lot of modern players who've never had much of a profession outside cricket. But in the early days, in the early captains, I think it's fascinating to see how, you know, you had a postman leading Australia and then a bank manager, and how their respective social standings and their respective skills all influenced the way they did the job. And Robinson is very keen to give that sort of broader portrait of the individual. At the same time, he's great on the cricket. You know, he gives these forensic accounts of the techniques of players who he never saw. And again, this is all down to, you know, when he's describing how perfect a player's late cut is, that's all down to that heavy research, those conversations. So there's a lot to be commended there. Did the book tell you enough about captaincy? Because it's ultimately, I know that sounds a strange thing to say, but it's a book about an awful lot of cricket captains. Do you think there is sort of a thesis here about, like, good and bad captaincy?
No, I don't, because I think actually, and it's an interesting question, because I was thinking that as I was reading it too, that actually there's not a huge amount of analysis of what makes a good captain more thoroughly than just the individual instances that we have in this book. Instead, this is sort of biographies of people who happen to have been captain at some point in their life, almost. You certainly wouldn't, you know, this is no Brearley in the sense that it's not a book that you would read and suddenly think that you'd learn something about how cricket captaincy had developed through the ages. But I kind of didn't mind that either, actually. I kind of didn't mind the fact that it was quite a light touch in that sense. Did you want more of that?
I think I was sort of I very much enjoyed the moments. There's a wonderful account of the Australian captain Darling's moment where he reversed the order on a very difficult pitch.
Yes.
And the his tail enders were able to his tail enders and himself were able to see out the night on this difficult pitch. The sun came out the next day, it got better, and I thought I wanted a bit more of, like, these are the different wheezes and tricks of captaincy. But I agree with you that I don't think that's what it's about. It's more a portrait of the individuals, and via that, a portrait of cricket at the time. You know, each portrait tells you an awful lot about cricket at that time and at that period.
And I think that actually taps into something quite fundamental about this book, which is that it is a very good read. It's the kind of thing that you can sit down and, you know, because it's based around chapters, you can sort of dip in and dip out of it in quite a satisfying way. And I certainly found it something that, you know, was a bit of a page turner to read.
Yes, and I think that's where his style deserves an awful lot of credit, because, you know, regardless of what I said earlier about statistics, it sort of zips along. It has this very unforced sort of thing to it that it feels almost like, you know, sitting with someone in a pub and recounting old friends. And I think it's interesting that Robinson was a real admirer of Cardus. And I think, as Hay says in the introduction, Robinson doesn't get to kind of Cardus levels of beautiful phrasing. But what he does do that maybe, you know, Cardus maybe is not so strong on is he just makes it very, very easy reading. It sort of, it, you know, kind of hums along. And as I think you said as well, works just as well as a sort of history that you can read in a big go, or just something to dip in and out of for pleasure.
Now, so that is On Top Down Under by Ray Robinson. You may have a bit of trouble getting hold of it. I certainly did. I ended up having to order it from the Bowell Bookmen, who I can heartily recommend. Little bookstore based down in Bowell that'll send you any cricketing books you might want. Anyway, shameless plug for the Bowell Bookmen, not that I have any particularly vested interest in them. Thank you for joining us for the, what was that? Is that the 91st? We're into the nervous 90s. 91st episode of Reverse Web Radio. During the time that we've been recording, a certain batsman would have scored something like 44 runs now, I think. Yeah. Thanks for bearing with us. Join us as ever over on Twitter @ReverseSwept, and we will be back again in a couple of weeks.